It's not really a question, but it's a... Dear Ajahn Kruner Dhammo, thank you for your talk earlier today. The part about clinging was especially helpful, so now I find that if I make a conscious effort to remove clinging from all thoughts, mental processes, being aware is so much easier and there's a lot less suffering. So thank you. Dear Ajahn Pasano, as inspiration for the rest of us, would you please talk about some of your milestone insights over your years of practice and what kept you going over the years, especially when you hit roadblocks? It's really interesting. I mean, when when Ajahn Jayasaro was tasked by the Sangha, he's an English monk. He was when I was the abbot of Wat Nanachat in Thailand, he was the assistant abbot, and he was tasked by the larger Wat Bopong Sangha to prepare Ajahn Chah's biography in Thai, and so that we spent quite a lot of time, and he in particular, but there was I helped out, a few others helped out, and we did all sorts of interviews with different monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, asking about their experiences with Ajahn Chah, and they, I mean, oftentimes we would ask, well, is there anything, any special teaching that you received from Ajahn Chah, or something that really was helpful for you to help clarify them? Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a, and, you know, and it was invariable as it come in this kind of theme, and sort of, yeah. I remember one time I was really suffering, and Ajahn Chah looked at me and said, "It's impermanent." And I mean, it's kind of like you know, there's a certain mundane reality to insights that are, you know, quite powerful. A lot of it is one's own kind of preparation and ready to hear the simple. So similarly for myself, you know, I think milestone insights. Yeah, it's, that's really suffering. You know, or that's that was, and as so that the these when you actually talk about them, they're kind of trite. but I wouldn't underestimate any anybody's ability to have some kind of insight that really is changes one's relationship to practice and really gives a solid foundation. But it's those so-called ordinary insights that are really quite powerful and potent. And so I think for myself, some of the maybe one that I can share. It was really a very powerful insight into the Satipatthana, just how the say those four foundations of mindfulness are, and again, I mean, how ordinary is that? I mean, fourfold is pretty basic. But just how, when we really are mindful and to look at our experience in terms of four foundations of mindfulness rather than in terms of our own self-perception, self-view, then, yeah, the whole ball game changes. That's quite... Because the Buddha is quite bold in his just his introductory statement in the sutta of on the four foundations of mindfulness. He just states baldly, "This is the direct way out of suffering, the ending of all defilement." It's okay. And you think, wow, that's really bold. But then you realize, oh, yeah, well, that's actually true. So, coming back to, and again, so you think, you know, mindfulness, I mean, how ordinary is that? But it really does change everything. Okay, there's two questions. One, inclining the mind toward happiness, joy, lightness, exhilaration, the good, sometimes feels a bit Pollyanna-ish. What about all the wars, refugees, my job, illness, pain, etc.? Aren't these also the way things are? Unpleasant, dark, and negative? Yeah. But it's you make a choice what you pay attention to. You know, if you want to... focus on all of the, even in the Buddhist time, it was all sorts of, wars, illness, pain, probably even more in your face than today. And the Buddha in particular being from the warrior caste, he wasn't sheltered from that reality, but you make a choice what you pay attention to because you want to take responsibility for the result that arises. And you can make it a bit Pollyanna-ish in the sense of I think trying to prop it up and blot out the negative is maybe the Pollyanna-ish way. Whereas if one recognizes, there's the dark and the light, and do I want to dwell in darkness or dwell in the light? There's pain and there is well-being. Do I want to dwell in pain or in well-being? It's not a negating the downside of things, but it's actually sometimes that reflection on the. And that's actually something that the Buddha talked about as a structure for investigation. in that, paying attention to directing attention to the say the drawback or the painful aspect of things. Paying attention to the benefit or the positive side of things, and paying attention to the way out or the escape from both of those things, and that's throughout the suttas, the Buddha used many different templates. As doorways to liberation. So that Four Noble Truths is the most common one. Dependent origination is another one. and the contemplation of the drawback, the benefit, the way out, is another. So that's in terms of, say, of our experience, feeling, thought, the world. We can, when we understand those things in their true nature, then we have a doorway to liberation. So that we make skillful choices in terms of what is it that supports our own aspiration and clarity of mind. The second is, you spoke of using the body as reference, backdrop for the breath, always coming back to the body. Doesn't this foster a sense of attachment to the body as mine? And what if the body is not in good shape, ill and hurting? Well, I think that's one of the things of actually coming back to the body is it's really in your face that it's not in good shape, it's ill, it's hurting. I mean, it's the nature of having a body. So it doesn't. That's a terrible kind of investment of calling it mine. I think it's a helpful way of say the more you come back to it, the more you say, "Phew, this is not mine. I really don't want to take it on as mine." And then when you realize that and then the body actually. You start to realize, it's not just the body that has that characteristic. All the aspects of mind, emotion, thought, it's exactly the same characteristic. So it's actually a motivation and support for relinquishment. Okay, Ajahn Khrunadamo's talk really hit the mark. We all told him at tea time that we thought he gave a great talk. okay, Ajahn Khrunadamo, you answered so beautifully the question, questions, I wanted to ask Lumpa today. Bows in gratitude. I'm doing well when sitting or walking. My container of mindfulness is filling. However, it seems to be leaking during every other activity. Walking to the meal, in my room, going to the bathroom, eating, help. I seem to be defeating my efforts. Well, I think one of the things is just recognizing that's actually happening. That's a great start because oftentimes, the tendency or the habit is to for us to to lose it when we've got a solid container. We're in the hall in front of the shrine, sitting with other people, and then it's very overt and explicit what we're doing, and so that momentum gets built of mindfulness and composure. But when there's just an opportunity to pay attention to anything else, we're pretty non-discriminating. Any old distraction will do. it, uh, um, And I will tend to take that. But actually recognizing, okay, that's what I'm doing. So that's a good thing. And then there's a putting forth that care during those other, and mindfulness of the body is really helpful in the sense of a grounding attention in the sensation of the body, the feel of the body. There's an anchor there that helps to develop that continuity of attention and alertness. So that's a useful tool to keep coming back to. Our minds don't have many boundaries sometimes. It can just slip out so quickly. There's a certain, say, gravity helps with just having a physical body, keeps that attention there. Also, to pay attention to what's it leaking out to? What is it? Because sometimes we just try to keep contained, and we don't really investigate. Well, what's the pull? What's the habit? What is the attraction to something that disrupts a continuity of alertness? So that the investigation is really important. You start to question and reflect. What's the mind drawn to, and what is its, what's it trying to get out of it? Because even we our practice, and then we get drawn to something negative. It's like, say, irritation. We're still trying to prop up a sense of we're trying to prop up a sense of self or a particular view or opinion, trying to sort of place ourselves in competition with somebody else. So there's the agenda of the self is kind of running in the background. So you can start to recognize, okay, that's more deep rooted than a little distraction, and then that we start to understand the nature of the mind more clearly as well. So that to use those, where the mind is being drawn out to highlight and investigate what's the nature of the mind and how to work with that. So it isn't just about trying to keep it all contained. It's sort of learning about what are the impulses underneath there. How can we apply the law of cause and effect to daily life? How can we apply this law to such a simple thing to remove suffering? Well, I was just paying attention to that simple process of. And similarly to what I was just talking about, you start seeing the causes and conditions that facilitate clarity and peace. And what are the causes and conditions that keep us distracted or keep us agitated? So understanding that, there's causes and there's conditions for things to manifest in certain ways, starting to understand those principles. And when we understand that those principles more clearly, you start recognizing that our well-being and our suffering, they have causes. They arise from certain conditions, and we can understand that more clearly. And when we do that, then we start making choices that will facilitate our, the ending of suffering and the arising of a steadier well-being, because it feels better. It's very simple. We're not that complicated as human beings, and we're not that uniquely messed up or anything. It's just, but it helps to see it clearly. Would you remind us what is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, as in the chant recollecting the Sangha, there's one of these esoteric Buddhist things. I remember one time. Four pairs are path. The pairs are the path and fruit, so that the path of practice and the fruit of the practice. And so those are the pairs, and the four are stream entry, once-returner, non-returner, arahant. So those are the four stages of realization in the Theravada scriptures. Each stage of realization or becoming a noble being, have the aspect of both the path that facilitates that, and the fruit of the path. So those are four pairs, eight kinds of noble beings. In a nutshell, what's the English translation of the lovely meal blessing? The chant that we do is it has a couple different themes. One is a sharing of blessings, or a dedicating of blessings, or a spreading of the goodness that comes through the goodness that's done. And the image that is alluded to is that, the filling of a vessel of water that then overflows and spreads out to others. So that's an image of the heart of goodness that touches others. So that recognizing that, and by that, the power of that goodness which spreads out, we dedicate those blessings for well-being. And also a recognition that, or establishing a wish on our part, acknowledging the generosity goodness that is the basis of the offerings that are made through that goodness, may it result in long life, happiness, good health, well-being. And may these blessings accrue. And then the very last chant is through the power of the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, may the devas protect you, may you live happily. So those are some of the what the meal blessing kind of encompasses. And then the last thing to say, right, thanks again for all your pearls of wisdom, including what you said about, the conditions that we have are good enough for enlightenment. That's encouraging. Yeah, it is. Okay, could you offer a bit of advice on how to deal with the apparent dichotomy between seeing people, including myself, as real and solid, for example, when sending the metta, and the doctrine of no-self, whereby there is no such imagined solidity at all, just an ever-changing combination of the khandhas. Thanks for your wonderful Dhamma talks and radiant presence. I think the first thing to emphasize is that the quote-unquote doctrine of no self is not actually that's actually a misnomer, because if you're saying no self, it means it isn't there, it doesn't exist. The anatta teaching of the Buddha is a middle way teaching, so that if one looks at the scriptural language, atta is self, so self, soul, this is mine, this is solid, this is absolutely the most important thing ever. No self doesn't exist, isn't there, completely, no imagined solidity at all. That is vīratā. And those are two extremes. The balance is anattā, that non-self. It's not a negation, but it's a recognition of its, because of its impermanent nature, the nature of it being a part of a causal process, there isn't anything that one can extract out and say, this is absolutely solid and steady and constant. It's non-self. It's a really important distinction, because the nature of the mind is to go to the concretization of existence and non-existence, being and non-being. But the Buddha is wanting us to look kind of down in the middle of that and pay attention to the process of arising and ceasing, of causes and conditions, and recognize that within that there's no solidity. It doesn't mean that it's not there, and it doesn't have an effect. But you can't stake claims over it. So then when you can't stake a claim over it, then you have to relinquish it. And that's freeing, liberating. Whereas trying to prop up the existence of it as something solid, or the negating and pushing away of it, annihilation of it, that keeps you bound and entangled. Dear Ajahn, what if a short breath never comes? Am I stuck on the long breath, or can I create a short breath and move on? Are the steps to Anapanasati sequential, and do I observe them, cultivate them, or both? Okay. Now you're stuck with living the rest of your existence with never having a short breath. I mean, one is short and long are kind of, relative anyway. But it's just sort of paying attention to the different modulations of the breath, the different appearances of the breath. And so the Buddha's just covering the bases. It isn't necessary for the development of mindfulness and breathing for it to be sequential and linear. If the long breath is more what you're experiencing, then that's what you use as the basis of that, developing that quality of knowing. That's I was talking about that this morning, using that the verb that's used. Oh, this is to be known. And then once that's, you've got a good enough foundation or basis of continuity of knowing, starting to become clear, starting to be comfortable, and that's when you start experimenting and training with the other steps. And it can be completely out of sequence. It's sort of whatever interests one or is useful, is beneficial, helpful in the practice. So, also, it's and I know for myself. I mean, thought of that as well. Of the, what is the short breath? Because it seems that, especially when you start with the paying attention to the breath as a meditation object. As you start, the breath tends to be kind of long. You're relaxing, so that there's the breath is breathing in. It's kind of long, but this is just my opinion. I have no idea what the scriptures say or other teachers, but that once the mind starts to become quite peaceful, then the body relaxes. There's a real ease, start to settle in. And when the actual whatever is a normal breath rate. What's the normal respiration rate for a human body? 12 to 20?
Mm, that's, yeah,
8 to 12, 16. Yeah, 8, 12, 16 per minute. That can slow down quite a lot. And oftentimes it's just quite short. You know, the body doesn't need so much oxygen, I guess. It just doesn't need it. There's a fullness of the body already. So I think that's my sort of take on the short breath, is that it starts to manifest after the there's a peacefulness starts to settle in both physically and mentally. How does one avoid controlling the breath when observing it? And that's a really good question, because sometimes that there's an unconscious tendency to control the breath or feel that we have to control it. So I think that's where paying attention to the body in terms of really relaxing, because oftentimes what happens, the tendency to control will it manifests physically in the sense that we'll tighten up and we try to make it happen, so that the conscious attention to relaxing and bringing an ease throughout the whole body allows the mind to relax its tendency to want to control. So that paying attention to that relaxing. Also just recognizing when we do try to get in and over control, then because it starts, you can feel it. It's uncomfortable. So that's it. Okay, just release, just relax, let go. Okay, and that attending to not just a mental letting go, but a physical letting go, relaxing, settling, letting it spread throughout the whole body. Then there's a feeling of safety and ease that starts to manifest, where you can sort of let that, because there's so much of the doer. We're trying to do stuff all the time. Relaxing around that, the chronic doer in ourselves. In addition to being aware of our body, is it acceptable to use visual imagery? That is, seeing oneself standing by the ocean, breathing in air created by the waves. How about doing Kegels? And basically anything that works. It's all fair game. So long as it's help support wholesome trains of thought and feeling, and doesn't get entangled in what is unskillful, unwholesome, negative. And it depends on, because some people are visual, say for myself, I'm much more of a tactile person. Not a whole lot of visual stuff going on. Sort of which is, you know, sometimes helpful. It's helpful not having an imagination. It keeps it simple. but I know one person Thai person. He grew up in Thailand, moved to Australia to study, and then ended up staying in Australia. And his whole family are meditators. The mother was a very accomplished meditator. So he received instruction when he was young and had the example of his mother, and, you know, as is usually the case, so you say, well, you know, how do you rebel against something like, well, you just don't meditate, you know. But then he realized after, as he became an adult, he really missed it. He had a real facility for peacefulness and meditation, and he'd just sit down, visualize, lifting up a cool glass of clear water, drinking it slowly, and then, you know, by the time he finished the imaginary glass of water, then he'd be in jhana. it was astounding. visual. He's just using the visual. So that, whatever works, in the sense of whatever helps the mind be peaceful, be clear, be uplifted, be bright. It all works. Okay. I have an English language question with an intention of deeper understanding. The phrase, I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart or mind imbued with loving kindness, etc. In all of these phrases, I can feel the intention, but when I look up the meaning of the underlined words, abide shows up as residing, continue, or stay. Pervading comes out as walking. Imbued as filled with, saturated. Is the phrase that simply I will continue walking filled with loving kindness? This makes sense, but I have a feeling that there's more to it, or why would the heart and mind be cut into four quarters? Yeah. Okay, well, one is that when we think of the four quarters, it's looking at four quarters of the compass, north, south, east, west, or front, back, off to each side. So it's kind of pervading and sort of radiating outwards is the image. And I think also with abide, then it means the choice of language is also sometimes, well, what is it because it's also translated in order to chant, so that part of it is, it's sort of poetry as well, so that, it's like in the loving kindness chant that we do, or the one of the chants that we do. May I abide in well-being, which is, it chants really nicely. Mat Metta, Ajahn Jeff translates it very correctly. May I be happy, which has a different ring to it. So sometimes, you know, something can be, linguistically correct, but, you know, for chanting, sometimes you have to use a little bit of poetic license or use words that have a bit of a ring to it, just to create a feeling, because for the chanting, then you're not just trying to. You don't want to confuse people either, but it's also having using the language so that it's pleasing to chant as well. It sounds good. So it's just that. I mean, that line is actually a good illustration. May I abide in well-being. It has a nice ring to it. And may I be happy. It is very correct. Further to your Dhamma talk this morning, does the breath body exist as an object of mind? As the Buddha mentions it so specifically, I'd be grateful for more clarification on the quote-unquote breath body. Definitely. I mean, it's an object of mind. I mean, this is how we perceive it, or how we feel it, how we experience it, so that it's a mental construct. It's a formation. It isn't as if it is some sort of something that has some independent existence, but just the nature of the breath. I think one of the things is to also reflect on, say, in the scriptural language, anapanasati, say, in breath, out breath, or the breathing process. So pana is breath, but pana is also kind of a life principle or life force. So that when you take the first precept, panatipata, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. So that living creature is a pana. It's a breathing being. It's a living being. So that the breath is also kind of like a life force, a life principle. So it's something that, you know, breathes life into us. So this sense of a breath body, it isn't as if it's some kind of distinctly formed thing, but it's a principle. A principle of energy, so that's it's what energizes and brings life into our being, our physical being anyway. So that the contemplation of the and the mindfulness of the breathing is not just being mindful of a mechanical process of sort of molecules of air being pumped in and pumped out of the lungs, but it's something that affects us and brings life to it. Sort of like the Buddha saying that the breath is another type of body or another kind of body that we experience. But it's something that we experience, we feel. So it's an object of mind in that sense. But it has has the effect of supporting the life principle. I notice that the calmer my mind becomes, the more imperceptible my breath is, to the point of feeling a suspension of breathing and at times a complete cessation. This sometimes seems to lead to sleepiness and torpor. How can I bring my mind back to a state of focus without manipulating my breathing? That's actually a really important aspect of say a breath meditation, in the sense that as there is this calming process taking place, then and the mind relaxes, the body relaxes, it becomes the breath slows down. If there isn't a sharpness of attention and awareness, then it's easy for the mind to sink into torpor. And this is where this balance of tranquility, like the breath settling, the mind becoming more tranquil, that tranquility has a certain effect, and that's where the balance of application of the mind is so important. So that directed thought evaluation, the lifting up of the mind to the object of attention, sustaining it, investigating, contemplating, reflecting, not to the and this is where balance is so important, because sometimes we're used to thinking, and then conking out, but we need to learn the skill of lifting up the mind, directing the thought processes, directing attention to the, say, an object of attention or an object of contemplation. And this is where interest is an effort are important. Because the tendency of tranquility is, we get tranquil, it puts us to sleep. But we need that tranquility, but then we also have to learn how to energize that tranquility so that there's a stillness and clarity of mind that is able to reflect and investigate without it turning into proliferation and projection. So that attention to balance is an important part of the. Because sometimes if there's a lot of thinking, reflecting, excitement over themes of Dhamma, then we need to attend more carefully to the tranquility aspect, settling, calming, stilling. But if that calming and stilling don't have a sharpness or a focus, then we need to apply investigation and bring up a theme of contemplation that allows a balance of clarity to establish itself. When negative feelings arise, whether they be fear, anxiety, loneliness, etc., how do we investigate them? Does breathing into these feelings and being fully present, without trying to push them away, help to become aware of the true cause of these feelings? Is the cause of these feelings always, quote-unquote, craving of some kind? I mean, the cause of those feelings is always negative feelings, or is always craving of some kind, but that's... you don't just want to just slap the label of craving on it in order to forget it, or because it's dharmically correct, because that doesn't mean there's any resolution. So that as the example here, yeah, breathing into it, or encouragement I'd be giving, or Ajahn Kurundamo gave this afternoon, finding the tools that allow us to be present, to feel, say, that dukkha of fear, anxiety, loneliness, without identifying and entangling oneself in that, sinking down into it, becoming that. And oftentimes it's the, you know, just that willingness to be present and to hold that with clarity and kindness, that is really the major force for kind of unraveling them, disentangling them. And it isn't all an analytical analysis of the true cause, because sometimes it keeps going on and on and on. It's all multi-layered, but a lot of it is sort of okay. It's like this, and recognizing the way that we react to it, or the way that we fear the implications of it, or the so that there's a sense of, okay, I can be present with this, I can be comfortable with this, and then you can, that the ability to be present and clear oftentimes is enough to unravel a lot of the complications that we have with the different negative feelings. And then it opens up some space for an alternative, either relinquishment or bringing a proactive directing of attention to an alternative which is more skillful or more positive. So you see, realize, oh, I've got choices here. Okay. In a Dhamma talk at Abhayagiri, you quoted Lumpa Cha as saying, Nibbana lies on the shores of death. Could you say more about this? It's really scary when people remember your Dhamma talks. I can't remember what I taught sometimes. But that is definitely a quote that Ajahn Chah, or something that Ajahn Chah said. And I think one of the things is it's kind of the sort of say shifting modes of Ajahn Chah, sort of out of the warm and fuzzy grandfatherly figure to get it together and don't mess around, go for the real deal, and sometimes we're not really ready to let go until we've really pushed ourselves to our limit. So sometimes that's a perspective that we need to reflect on. Oftentimes we're really not ready to let go until there's absolutely no other alternative left, that we finally give up. That's more often the case. So that sense of Nibbana lying on the shores of death. So that's something to reflect on. Where am I holding back? Where am I not willing to give myself to the practice or to relinquishment or to skillful action? Because in the end, death is always going to be there to welcome you. And have we done what needs to be done? Okay. This is the last question. And this wasn't a setup. This just was the last one there. How are you satisfied and or dissatisfied with students? I guess it depends on my mood at the moment. I think one of the things if people are whatever expectations I have are my expectations, and I'll get frustrated or elated because of that, and that's my suffering. My own satisfactions and dissatisfactions are how I create my suffering. So I think that's a helpful, for all of us, because we go around trying to find satisfaction and pleasure and comfort in either the approval or disapproval of others, or go up and down. So that learning how to be more independent within oneself is really important skill to be cultivating. Okay, let's have a short break and then come back for chanting.